Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy and WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Miles Makovsky.
And I'm Ben Saratan. Our first segment tonight is a recording of Albany County Legislator Carolyn McLaughlin discussing local electoral redistricting at last week's South End Community Collaborative Zoom meeting.
Then we'll hear a COVID update from Albany County Executive Dan McCoy, who has been regularly addressing the growing crisis in the Capital Region.
And later on, vendors react to the Troy Waterfront Farmers Market, moving its winter location from the heart of downtown to the old Price Chopper building on 2nd Avenue in the Lansingburg neighborhood.
After that, the last of a five-part discussion from the Underground Railroad Educational Center on the book Black Reconstruction in America, 1860 through 1880, by W.E.B. Du Bois.
And finally, Julia Rosenberger is a biochemistry PhD student at the University of Delaware and runs a blog called The Cheminist. She discusses the COVID-19 vaccine and women in STEM. And now, some headlines.
The Times Union reports that deaths due to COVID-19 in the Capital Region more than doubled during the month of November. Local counties reported 49 coronavirus deaths this month, compared to 20 in October and 6 in September.
Nurses at Albany Medical Center Hospital began a 24-hour strike Tuesday, part of an ongoing stalemate with the hospital's administration over their labor contract and concerns the hospital is not doing enough to protect nurses and patients from the coronavirus. Roughly 150 nurses have contracted COVID-19. The nurses accuse the hospital of lack safeguards and are particularly upset at having to reuse single-use masks.
The Daily Gazette reports that Governor Cuomo has announced a five-point winter plan designed to combat the spread of COVID-19. In addition to managing hospital capacity, components include bolstering testing, safely keeping schools open, and ensuring equitable distribution of vaccines once one becomes widely available. A key strategy is monitoring patient loads and ensuring hospitals don't get overwhelmed, which could prompt another shutdown like last spring. As of Monday, 35,032 people were hospitalized statewide, roughly the same as on March 23rd, as cases began to mount. Numbers hovered in the 400s for much of late August and September, when they then began to steadily increase.
A bit of breaking news. Attorney General Bill Barr just minutes ago stated in an interview with the Associated Press that the Justice Department has not seen any evidence of election fraud, despite President Trump's claims. It is not clear yet whether or not these new comments will change the president's course of action, pursuing legal action regarding the election.
And 65 years ago today, on December 1st, 1955, Rosa Parks refused to move to the back of a city bus in Montgomery, Alabama. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. This is local news produced by the community for the community, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
This program is kept on the air by many volunteers and sanctuary sustainers. Thank you. To hear all of the stories on today's program, you can visit mediasanctuary.org. And to send comments or suggestions, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or call 518-272-2390. You can also find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Media Sanctuary.
To start off our stories for tonight, we'll hear from HMM reporter Paul Smart, who fills us in on the latest developments in upcoming rezoning attempts in Albany County, particularly as it relates to ongoing Supreme Court decisions on the national census. Recently, local legislator Karen McLaughlin held a meeting with the South End Community Collaborative on Zoom, where she explained a number of new committees coming forth in the area. We'll hear a recording from that meeting.
All week, many have been watching the Supreme Court to see how they handle the Trump administration's new attack on census figures and to see how that's going to affect redistricting over the coming year. Here in New York State, we catch up with County Legislator Carolyn McLaughlin at last week's South End Community Collaborative Gathering on Zoom, where she spoke about new redistricting committees for the city and county to work with whatever census figures get released in the new year, much of that depending on how the Supreme Court of our nation deals with the current administration's attempts to curb who gets counted.
The Albany County Legislature is in the process of recruiting individuals to serve on the Albany County Redistricting Commission. And there's actually two panels that will be put in place. One is the larger commission, and then there's a subcommittee that will be dealing with drawing the lines for minority districts. So each commission, the larger commission is composed of 9 people, and then the minority district commission will be composed of 7 people. And that commission will be particularly looking at the districts in the city of Albany. Right now, there are five districts in the city of Albany that are minority districts. And we may be looking at, depending on how the census data comes out, we anticipate we may be looking at an additional minority district. But we're looking for people to sit on both those commissions. And all of the work that we did regarding the census is going to be played out right through this redistricting commission. So the city has a redistricting committee, the county has one, as well as the state. So in drawing the lines for the state legislature. So what you have to do is just go to the Albany County website, and then go to the Albany, look for under the icon for government and look under the legislature. And there is a simple application right there that you can fill out and just expressing your interests. You cannot be an elected official. You cannot be a relative of an elected official. And when I say elected official, you can't be from a committee person, an elected committee person, a council member, a county legislator, et cetera. You cannot serve on the commission. We're trying to keep it as nonpartisan as possible. But it's a great opportunity to learn, you know, the layout of the community. There'll be public hearings that you will be working on to get information from residents, as well as from elected officials. They will be coming to public hearings, but you will draw the lines for what each district is gonna look like. And you will see where the population, where all the demographics have played out with the census. That's the data that you will be working with. So we really need people of color to submit. We need everybody to submit. We need people from all over the county, the hill towns, as well as the city of Albany. So I encourage as many of you as possible. It is time consuming. It can be so, but it doesn't start until next year after we get the numbers. It'll be early part of next year. The work will begin, but we need people to step forward. It will be a valuable experience for you. Something that we only do every 10 years. I've served on the commission in the past with the city. And it is. It's eye-opening. And I hope that some of you will step up and give us your time and energy to participate in this worthwhile endeavor. Thanks, Tom. If anybody have any questions?
Well, Carolyn, I wonder if you could take us back a little time machine here. And you were involved in the city redistricting, but the county redistricting has had many legal twists and turns. And I know your sister has been very much involved in that, Wanda Willingham. Can you recall for us?
Yes. The past? For the last 3 census and redistricting undertakings, the county has been sued by the people to get the minority districts. So in the last 30 years, each census. So that was, this is 2017, 2000, and 1990. This county was sued to ensure that minority districts were formed. And as a matter of fact, the last redistricting, I had to test, I was a part of the lawsuit as well. And what that means is the numbers just, it just fell. And that's why we have the Minority Redistricting Commission as well this year, to prevent any us going down that same road. Because people just felt that, and legislators felt that the numbers did not, the lines that were drawn did not reflect the population shifts in Albany County, and particularly in the city of Albany. Right now we have minority districts in one, first, second, third, fourth, fifth, first, second, third, fourth, and fifth. Yes, and I represent the first district, which is down here in the south end. And the I share the second district, minority district, with Sam Fine, and then Arbor Hill, West Hill, and North Albany are the other minority districts. We believe there's an opportunity up in the 11th district to turn that into a minority district, the 11th ward, the area that encompasses the 11th ward. So, so we've had to testify to talk about the different things. One person, one vote, we felt was in those lawsuits was not adhered to. And you have 51% of the district has to be considered minority. And when you look at Hispanics and African-American community, it just seemed like, how could you not have? And as you look around where you live, you can see how the community has changed over time. And it began 30 years ago. It started the shift. And that's why we have the districts that we have now.
This has been Paul Smart reporting for Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
You just heard audio from a meeting of the South End Community Collaborative in Albany County, in which legislator Carolyn McLaughlin discusses the possibility of redistricting in the upcoming year. As reporter Paul Smart pointed out, this is particularly important as the Supreme Court is currently weighing a case involving the national census that could have tremendous impact on districts nationwide.
COVID cases in the United States continue to surge nationwide, showing absolutely no signs of slowing down anytime soon, despite a number of positive developments concerning possible vaccines. Following the national trend, cases in the capital region are increasing every day, which leads many to believe that the coming months will be even more challenging than this previous exhausting year. Reporter Paul Smart brings us to this recording of a public address given by County Executive Dan McCoy, who tells us it's going to be tougher out there for us.
As we all know now, the coronavirus is surging again. We're tired. Many of us slipped in our vigilance over recent weeks, sharing meals and other activities. Now the numbers are almost at a point where we'll be going back to lockdown, even though a vaccine is on the horizon. We catch up with Albany County Executive Dan McCoy's updates, this one recorded as the current week started.
So, good morning, everyone. And, it's going to be tougher out there for all of us. It's here. It's going to get worse. And, you know, it's one of the things we're trying to figure out on the county level, as well as the state and a national level. Where do we go from here? You know, waiting for the vaccine. As people know, it's going to take time to get out. They're trying to prioritize. Does it go to nursing homes? Does it go to first responders? Does it go to hospital staff? All great questions, and something we're going to be addressing here in the next couple of days to kind of talk about how it's going to be put out throughout the community. The plan that Dr. Whalen's team's had in place for years, the state and the feds have different ideas of how they're going to put this vaccine out. But I want to make it clear to people, and I know the light's at the end of the tunnel, and everyone feels that the vaccine's here, that we can just go out and do whatever we want. the bad mistakes or hiccups, you could say, that we made on Halloween, on Thanksgiving, is really going to affect us this next 2 months. This is going to be the worst we've ever seen. I'm not trying to scare you. I'm just putting the facts out there. Do your research, read it. It's just not here. We've been fortunate enough that our numbers have been lower here in New York State than anywhere else. You know, fortunate. But, you know, it was one of the things that Dr. Whalen and I talk about. We go back and forth about numbers. Do you just come out and put out numbers? Do you just say, hey, we're at this? 100 is going to be the norm probably going forward in the next couple of weeks. And do you get numb to it? Because we kind of have. You know, we're like, well, it's 100. Let's look at this. Let's look at that. It just lets us know that people are putting their fatigued. They're putting their guard down. And what happened on Black Friday and this weekend is really going to tell us how these next couple weeks and month are going to be. And from all the data that we're seeing and everything that we're getting, to all the haters out there that hate me doing this every day, I got no choice because you didn't do the right thing. You didn't think masks worked. You know, everyone's like, well, that's here. The mask must not work. Well, I'm glad we're all scientists. Am I a little frustrated? Yes. Yes, I am. Because you know what? We're almost there. And we need to continue to work in a partnership. We need to be there. And to the people doing the right thing, thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I think Dr. Whalen and I have said this before. Please stay home. Don't go out. Don't go anywhere unnecessary, not unless you have to do something. Because we can get through this. We can keep the curve down. But, you know, we're looking at the micro cluster, and I got to be honest with you, we're probably going to pass yellow people and go right to orange, the rate we're headed. And we'll get into that in the next couple of days, but the way we're looking at it, it's here. You know, even if we got reset, the numbers we're having, it's like some areas will be orange. I'm worried about yellow. Now I'm looking at orange. So please, please be part of this solution, not part of the problem. I know it's 263 days later. We're in the 38th week since March 12th. I know we're all tired. But I do want to recognize the county resident we lost yesterday. Yes, he was a man in his 90s. But again, to the family, my prayers, my condolences go out to you. It's tough to lose anyone. I don't care if they're 90, 97, 104. I don't care if they're 10. You know, it's tough to lose a loved one. So to the families and to the 158 people that have died since this. My condolences and prayers go out to your family, as always, and we're always here for you. So today we have 5,743 positive cases of the coronavirus, 2,272 people that are currently mandatory quarantine. We have an increase of 105 positive cases overnight. So of the new 105 cases, we know 23 had close contact to a positive case. One reported traveling in a state, one was a healthcare worker, and 80 do not have a clear source of infection at this time. As of today, there's 23,266 people that have completed quarantine. 4,859 tested positive for the virus. We have an increase of recovery of 117 since yesterday. So some of the things that we keep talking about. As of today, we have 72 people currently hospitalized from the virus, the most we've ever seen in Albany County. There were 10 new hospitalizations just over last night. This is now the fourth time in just over a week that we set a record for the number of residents hospitalized. Another record this month, November, I did not want to hit, and I'm not proud of. Yesterday there were 67, Saturday we had 61. November 20th, we set the record at 45. Our hospitalization rate is now 1.25% of those who have tested positive. Yesterday that rate was 1.18. 11 patients are currently in the ICU. Yesterday that number was 8, and the day before that was 6. On November 1st, just to give you a little point of view, we had 0.71% hospitalization rate. Now we're at 0.125. In the month of November, we had a total of 162 people hospitalized. That's a 30% of our total since the outbreak started in March. What's alarming is why I said this in the beginning, and why, yes, I am just slightly frustrated. Because everyone feels we're at the end, and they're going out and doing bad things that are making you go into the hospital, making you get sick, and making you pass this COVID-19 around. That's an average of 5.4 new daily hospital admissions this month. And this is what scares the hell out of me. It's not just the number of positives we report each day, it's the infection rate. What those led to more residents going to the hospitals and more residents potentially dying. And we're likely still haven't seen the full effect of what this large gathering on Thanksgiving, on the holiday, on the weekends, and the infection rate's gonna be like coming. Over the last 5 days, there's been an average of 100.4 new positive cases each day. Yesterday, it was 101.2. Looking at our percent positive rate, Albany County has a 7-day rolling average has now hit 3.8% using the data from November 28th. The 7-day average of Capital Region now is at 2.97. Ultimately, the best way to protect yourselves and others to prevent us from going into a micro cluster zone is to go out less, avoid large gatherings, wear a mask, cough into your arm, clean your hands, and stay 6 feet apart.
This has been Paul Smart reporting for Hudson Mohawk Magazine. County Executive McCoy's broadcasts are available each day at 10:30 a.m., usually on Facebook or on his Albany government website. Remember, be safe out there. The vaccine's coming, but it's going to take a while. Be safe.
That was a recording of Albany County Executive Dan McCoy addressing the public concerning the alarming recent uptick in COVID cases, both nationally and at the county level. He did not mince words in his address. He believes that things are going to get worse and that bigger challenges lie ahead for those in New York State. McCoy also re-emphasized the importance of continued mask wearing, hand washing, and social distancing. These are the best tools we have in stopping the spread. This piece was reported, once again, by Paul Smart.
For those just tuning in, I'm Miles Makovsky.
And I'm Ben Saratan. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, WOOC 105.3 FM Troy, and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, please check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. Or get in touch with us through email at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
The Troy Waterfront Farmers Market is moving its winter location to the old Price Chopper building at 865 2nd Avenue in the Lansingburg neighborhood of Troy. Starting December 5th, shoppers will find most of their favorite vendors indoors at the new winter location. HMM correspondent Corinne Carey, Lansingburg resident and Farmers Market superfan, talked to the vendors about how they feel about the move, as she did her Thanksgiving shopping last week.
The Troy Waterfront Farmers Market is a destination for foodies from all over the Capital Region and beyond. In 2019, the Farmers Market won the People's Choice Award according to the American Farmland Trust for favorite farmers markets across the country. This year, the Troy Farmers Market has struggled to stay in business amidst the pandemic. Throughout the spring and the summer, management at the market went to great lengths to keep market goers safe by creating a one-way lane for shoppers to pass by all of the various vendors. The market extended its outdoor waterfront season until the end of November, but now rates of COVID-19 infection are rising in the Capital Region and it's getting colder. Just before the Thanksgiving holiday, the Albany Times Union reported that the Troy Waterfront Farmers Market would be moving from one part of the riverfront to another. Starting on December 5th, the Troy Waterfront Farmers Market will move indoors to their new winter market location at the location of the former Price Chopper on 2nd Avenue in Lansingburg. I live in Lansingburg, so I was thrilled about the news, but I wanted to hear what the vendors thought. So when I went to the market to pick up the ingredients for my Thanksgiving dinner, I talked to the vendors. I found that some were skeptical, some were willing to try it out, Some were apprehensive about the safety of moving indoors, but for the most part, many vendors were excited that the market would continue to be a year-round market and that a whole crop of new people might have exposure to what the farmers market has to offer.
My name is Matthew Leon, and I'm a farmer at Detroit Farmers Market. I'm one of the two farmers that runs Love and Mama Farm. And to the question of the Troy Farmers Market going into Lansingburg, personally, we're deciding to take the winter off and not do the farmers market. It's not really because it went to the Price Chopper, though. It's more because of just the pandemic and us thinking that it won't really be worth our time to be standing at market for that long. We're going to do just direct online store through the Troy Farmers Market online shop, which works really well for a lot of farmers. So yeah, we're happy to have any support we can get to be able to sell our product, honestly. And the Troy Farmers Market is a great asset to any farmer who is lucky enough to get into it.
Thank you, yeah, I appreciate that.
All right, enjoy, happy holidays. What can I do for you?
That tomato, and I'm gonna get some
hard cider.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really glad the market can continue. I think it's important for the community, and I'm glad that we found a space that seems safe and comfortable.
And are you going to be there?
I haven't actually talked to my farm about it yet. I think we are. I assume we are, but I am not sure.
Okay. Thank you. And how much altogether?
So we were at 20 plus the tomato, so we're at 24, please.
Well, that's hopefully a good location. You know, you don't know until you try.
Can you say your name and what farm you're with?
Dale Cornell, Cornell Farm.
And are you going to be there?
Yes, yeah, we'll be there.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Looking forward to it?
Yeah. Better than being outside the elements.
Better than being... Thank you very much. I appreciate
That's
it.
That's great. Thank you.
Bianca Dupuis from the Broken Mold Studio, Troy, New York.
And what's your reaction to the farmers market moving to Lansingburg for the winter?
I'm thrilled that we're going to be able to have it all year round like normal. I don't think it matters exactly where it is as long as we can all keep coming together and making it happen. Are you going to be there? I'm going to be there.
My name is Tamar, yeah? Tamar Palmer, yeah?
And what farm are you with?
Saratoga Apples.
Saratoga Apples.
Yeah.
And what's your reaction to the farmer's market moving to Lansingburg?
Yeah, man, it's a very good look over here, man. Nice, yeah. Everyone's coming all the time for a good time.
Yeah.
There's some nice food and stuff like that every year, you know what I mean?
Great.
People like it, yeah.
Are you going to be there?
Yeah.
Nice,
yeah, it's nice, yeah. So I've got to be there this year too, yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, man, nice.
I'm Kaylee Zimmerman, and I'm with Schenectady Distilling Company. I feel a little excited and apprehensive about the market moving inside. I'd like being outside, but it's going to get cold and snowy, so, you know, this could be a good change if we can stay safe.
We got it already.
Two.
Okay.
One of each.
And we're going to get one of these.
5 1/4, Paula. Kathy Twork from Battenkill Valley Creamery. And I think it's going to be a good idea. It's going to be larger. I know we won't have as many Troy people from right down in the city, but I think it's worth a try. And we'll be there.
Arlie Johnson from Sweet Tree Farm. I think it's okay. We're given a hard choice as far as COVID, and the atrium building's under construction this spring, I believe, as well as all the issues that we would have if we moved in there. It's the best that I feel the professionals that run the market, the best option, the best decision that they could make given a time crunch, as well as I think they made a good decision. They're better at making decisions than most people. So.
And are you going to be there?
Yeah, I will. I'll be there as long as it works out. Hopefully the people follow us, the customers. It should be pretty good. And if not, we'll have the online farmers market.
Great.
So that'll be good. Sean O'Connor with RNG Cheese.
And what's your reaction to the move to Lansingburg?
You know what? I'm excited and apprehensive at the same time. You know, it's we'd love to be outside. And of course, we, you know, need to be inside for a few months. It'll be interesting. You know, I like the space for sure. I think it's as good as could be done. We'll see who comes and how the situation's handled, but it'll be an interesting one.
Is it Lansingburg that gives you pause?
Not at all. Actually, my company's in Lansingburg.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we're RNG Cheesemakers. We're right in Troy, right in Lansingburg. So we're about halfway in between here and there. You know, at first I thought, are people who normally come to this location, if they'll go to the Lansingburg, that's less my concern now. You know,
my concern is strictly that it's an indoor location. And it's just got to be handled properly, you know. And,
does the way that they handled this summer give you confidence?
Oh, you know, the Troy Farmers Market's been really cautious the whole way, more cautious than other farmers markets that I deal with. I'm very confident in the way they've done things. So, you know, I'm sure they're going to do the best.
Might not be enough.
That's right, you know. So you got to be as careful as you can be, you know, on your own. And people have to make their own decisions if they're gonna attend or not.
Yeah.
Hello. Hi, this is Gregor Trieste, producer, maker of Budapesto. And we are excited to, definitely be available and go indoors. So
yeah.
I haven't been to the particular site. But from what I hear, it's going to work. It'll be more easy access with the parking lot. And it might be a little warmer than the atrium, so.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so we'll be there with a nice brood of vendors.
Yeah.
So.
And what do you think about the neighborhood, Lansingburg?
Again, I'm not too, I mean, I'm familiar enough with downtown Troy, and this is what I guess is considered North Troy.
Yeah.
So I can't judge it. I can't
but you're
say
willing to give it a try.
Oh, absolutely, 100%. Yeah,
great.
To be available, because that's we got to do that.
Yeah. All right, well, thank you. I appreciate it.
My name is Sherwood Ludwig. I'm from Harvest Spirits in Valencia.
What do you think about the move to Lansingburg?
I think it's a wise decision. I understand that the places in the area are hard and few and far to come by. So finding such a wonderful spot that's still in our local area is fantastic. I understand that the old location needs work. So giving them the time that they need while also giving the vendors the space that they need to continue should be able to keep people in business in an environment that's not really conducive for that.
What do you think about the surrounding area?
Where there's us, people will come. I'm not concerned about the necessarily what's around the area, because at the end of the day, people come to the Troy Farmers Market from all over the state and beyond. So moving, 10 minutes, 15 minutes away, maybe a little upsetting outright, but shouldn't cause any more ruffled feathers than you'd expect.
Do you think it's going to open the market up to some new people?
Absolutely. It's new environment, new faces, new places. Any opportunity that people can to get someplace that gives them a new perspective in life, they go for it.
Right. And are you going to be there?
Absolutely.
Thank you so much. I
My
really
pleasure.
Appreciate it.
And now for part 5 of an ongoing series. HMM roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry recently participated in a study group hosted by the Underground Railroad Education Center, analyzing Black Reconstruction in America, an important and lengthy book written by sociologist W.E.B. Du Bois. In this segment, we'll hear the group's thoughts on Chapter 9, titled The Price of Disaster, in a discussion moderated by Center founders Paul and Mary Liz Stewart.
I wanted to bring up something on Constitution, too. As a lot of you probably have studied, that the Constitution came from the Iroquoian Haudenosaunee government, but the two things that our government did not immediately accept and practice was the equality of women and people of color. And I might say that the great peace maker, the Ganawiya, that gave the Haudenosaunee that system was a Wyandotte, who was a member of my tribe. You know, we've always, the one thing that has always, and it didn't take a Guadagnaguia to say it, but that, you know, women, people of color, you know, equal. And it's also, if they had also brought the principles of the Quakers, which is my other family, is the same way. That's why they lived among the Wyandots and didn't have any problems. But that's the two major issues that were missing from the Constitution from day one was when they adopted the Great Peace, they purposely dumped out those two provisions.
You know, I want to say that a lot of things in Chapter 9 are things that you could see today, you know, what's happened today. You know, even though Du Bois was talking about things in their time, some of the same questions that they were dealing with during that time and that they was talking about are some of the things that are going on today, are some of the questions that we haven't resolved or that they haven't been dealt with. Du Bois, and I put in there, he looked at the Reconstruction in a Marxist way. And if you read the book, you know, he quoted Marx a couple of times or a few times. And Marx did send letters back and forth over here to the working class, to the working class people, you know, and to some of the leaders. But I want to say that even today, when you look at the working class, and I always say the white working class, you know, they don't say the black working class, but the white working class, how they voted for a multi-millionaire person to be president of this country. And they that seemed like they voted against their own interests. They, you know, he's against universal health care. He's against full employment. It's a lot of things that the multimillionaire in his interest that is not in the interest of the white working class, but yet and still they went along. But why? See, the question we still ask is why? What keep coming into the mix to keep dividing the white working class from the black working class or from the poor people? What become in the mix? And back during that time, they brought in racism, which it wasn't prevalent in Europe. Racism wasn't prevalent in Europe, and the white working class in Europe was going through some changes. And that's why they was having all that struggle. That's how Marx came about, because of all the struggle that was going on over there. And he started, you know, looking into it and developing those philosophies and ideologies. But when it came to this country over here, you know, the white working class, if you read the chapter, there was a lot of struggle between the white working class and black people. As a matter of fact, white working class really didn't see blacks as a working class. They didn't even see them as human, you know, per se. So I'm just saying that, you know, some of the issues and some of the questions that we are talking about and we are going through are some of the same questions that are being raised today. They have to be dealt with, that they have to have some resolve, and they haven't gotten their resolve yet.
Yeah. Well, I think even, you know, Holly's references to equality, why were those removed or eliminated? Why were they dropped out? I see it in my mind, it's a power issue. The negative fallout, removing equity, it's hard for me to comprehend. It's, you know, in terms of what you were suggesting, Willie, or what we see contemporarily with Trump, the negative fallout of people who seem to be enamored with him, and yet the negative fallout that affects them negatively. Where's the disconnect? Is it because what Tim was suggesting, that there's this, seems to be this lag between how we deal with how perceive reality and where reality really is? I don't know.
I was just going to throw this in because of, there's a seminary in California, but they're big process theology people. And this pastor at this church that I was at working with in Tucson, this guy was he graduated out of there. And so I got in discussions with him about the nature of God. You know, I was like, is God an omniscient, omnipotent force? And I'm pretty much against it. I think it's a really bad idea. But here's this guy who graduated from there, and he's just like, yeah, it is. It's like, you haven't read your Whitehead. You don't know what theology, you don't know what process theology is. Or you don't, you know, and it's just like, no, God has to be omniscient. Otherwise, you have no sense of what God is. You know, so you can have all these great progressive ideas, but then when it comes down to it, the core of what you're working on and what defines moral structure for you, if it says, you know, this, I oversimplify it, but with women, I've heard this, women are tied to their bodies. They've got menstrual cycles, you know, and they will never have the intellectual capacity of the male. And therefore, you know.
We need a good laugh on that one.
The presumption is that intellectual capacity is what makes a human being human being. But to turn that over, that's just like, whoa, we can't go there. Mm-hmm. Omniscient God, you can't get rid of omniscient God. That's just, we can't even touch that. And I think if we can't touch those things, then we're just kind of caught up with these demons in our brains. And I don't know, we don't have answers for it. That's what I hated about philosophy classes and love. It's like, you get floating around. It's like, well, there's no real answer here. You know, so like, you're going to have to figure that out on your own. You know, and of course, that's what being an adult is. But we don't
we don't like that. It's not comfortable. We want the easy answer. And like, oh, look at that. There's a Trump. He'll get us one.
I think in terms of, the white working class or whatever, voting against its own interests, I mean, I see that entirely as a function of, you know, what do we perceive to be the data that helps us understand reality? And, you know, one of the things that was really neat when we were growing up is that there were like four or five channels, and there was usually one or two newspapers. And that was nice because it was like a manageable collection of information. There was UPI, AP, and I don't know, it was some other. And there was pretty much a unity about what the facts were, even though they were wrong. I mean, and I don't want to say that because it's sort of like, you know, there was a dominant philosophy about what the world was and how the world was organized, you know, in the midst of the Cold War, and it was wrong. You know, the Soviets were wrong. They thought they had more influence than they had. The Americans were wrong because they thought the Soviets had more influence than they had. And there were all these things going on that had to do with, I don't know, I want to say the natural uprisings of people resisting powerful interests. And then playing, you know, the United States and the Soviet Union off one another. You know, it's like, oh, this year we're going with the United States. You know, they're going to get money from them. And next year we're going to go with the Soviet Union, and the United States is going to go all upset, and they're going to give us more money. You know, and that wasn't the way it came across to us in the press, whatnot. But at any rate, so now we're in a situation where we have 100 cable channels. You know, the newspapers are losing power. Everything's on social media, or it's on the internet, whatever. And it's sort of like nobody's, you know, people are keying into whatever their channel of information is that they feel comfortable with or that they trust.
It's hyper information. I mean, the fact that we're sitting here talking about a book that takes time to read, and it is a volume of information, getting people to read something or to pay attention to something more than a 5-second period is very hard.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so like during the campaign, like they said down in South Florida, there are a lot of people from Colombia and Venezuela and Cuba, whatnot, who voted for Trump because the Trump campaign's advertising targeted to them, persuaded them that the issue here had to do with socialism, and socialism meant Cuba, of course, and you know, and the kind of society that they have there, where they really are very limited with a lot of stuff they have, because primarily because of American boycotts of Cuban markets, but they see it as a place of scarcity and authoritarianism and this, that, and the other, and so they voted for Trump. Because that's the channel that they were listening to. Those are the messages that they were hearing. And other people in other corners of the world were reacting in different ways. And sort of like we're here, you can sort of look at the map of how the different areas voted, the blue areas and the red areas. And you see that people in urban centers tended to have points of view that were more unified for those urban centers, and people out in rural areas reacted differently. I mean, that can't be universally true but yet at the same time, I think it was, you know, in terms of large. There was one, in the Kansas there? There's one, or was it Nebraska? The one, as congressional district, I guess, that had an elector connected with it. So you had one little blue spot in the middle of all this, you know?
Maybe they ripped out all the internet then.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But I guess in some ways I wish that we could go back to a fewer channels so that we could at least all begin to have a conversation together and not be so splintered.
You know, I think about that, but then it's like, who's managing the channels?
Right,
whose agenda is being presented through the fewer channels? So I see it as a double-edged sword.
Yeah, it is.
That was part 5 of roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry's recording of a group study session hosted by the Underground Railroad Education Center based in Albany. Moderated by UREC founders Paul and Liz Mary Stewart, the study group discussed Chapter 9 of W.E.B. Du Bois' massive Black Reconstruction in America, an important historical work.
And now for an interview by HMM reporter Spencer Keeble. The Chemist is a blog run by Julia Rosenberger, a chemistry and biochemistry PhD student at the University of Delaware. Julia discusses her recent blog posts on the coronavirus and some aspects of the disease that deserve more coverage. She also describes her experience as a woman pursuing a PhD in STEM with tips for those considering graduate research. The Chemist provides scientific information that is relevant and accessible to everyday people. Since launching in September, Julia has covered information about coronavirus and the disease it produces, as well as updates on the safety and efficacy of vaccines in clinical trials.
Hi, I'm Julia Rosenberger. I went to school with Spencer in Albany at the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences, where we both got our bachelor's of science in chemistry. And now I'm at the University of Delaware studying to earn my PhD, also in chemistry and biochemistry. And I recently started a blog called The Chemist, and it's basically just to make science more accessible for the regular person, especially now. All of the misinformation going around about coronavirus really sort of jump-started this blog for me. I've always liked making science accessible for people and explaining like what I'm doing in graduate school to my family who has no idea about science. So I really like that avenue anyway. And then all of this coronavirus discussions getting sort of out of control, I thought I'd educate people in a way that everyone can understand.
So what are some of the topics you've been covering in your blog posts?
So right now, I started it in the middle of September, and since then, I've only done coronavirus posts. I've covered the virus itself, the disease, how your body sort of reacts to being infected, vaccine posts, and testing, and reinfection, mutations, things like that. So yeah, heavily focused on the virus right now, just because that's what's been in the news, and I think that's what a lot of people want to hear about right now. But eventually, I do want to get into other science topics that are applicable to people besides the virus.
And so what are some concepts that you've described in your blog posts that maybe haven't been talked about enough in like mainstream media?
Yeah, so I think one really big thing that's recently come to my attention is the difference in testing accessibility from state to state, sometimes even county to county in some states. So for example, I'm in Delaware right now, and we are very, very lucky. Our state has set up statewide testing. There's free walk-up testing for residents of Delaware every day in the state, in every county. And it's recently come to my attention that that's not the case in every state, where even some states you need to have symptoms or prove your exposure to coronavirus to get a test. And that is kind of backwards to me, because asymptomatic carriers are a huge part of this virus and a huge reason why it's spreading so much, and sort of the reason that we're in this pandemic. And if you can't get a test if you don't have symptoms, that kind of defeats the purpose of getting a test. Because if you say you do have symptoms, you should stay home. You like should assume that you have coronavirus if you have the symptoms of coronavirus. So you should stay home. If you've been exposed to someone with coronavirus, then you should also stay home. So I'm not saying those populations shouldn't get tested. I'm just saying it makes more sense for asymptomatic carriers to also have equal access to testing. Just make it free and accessible for as many people as possible, in my opinion.
That's totally relevant. It's really cool that in Delaware, you can just walk up, even if you don't have symptoms. Because in New York, I thought our testing program was the best, but it's actually kind of hard to get into like the major test site at UAlbany. You have to have symptoms. I remember I've tried to get in a couple times and I never got contacted back because I didn't have symptoms. And you have to call ahead at least the day before, so you can't just walk up. So it's really interesting that Delaware's testing is so much more accessible.
Yeah, and in some states, definitely in New York, based on like what a friend of mine has said, but some states, if you don't have symptoms and want to test, you have to pay upwards of $100, which doesn't make things accessible for people.
That might be like part of the reason that there's economic and racial disparities.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that is another thing that I've covered in my second post on coronavirus. I talk about at-risk populations, and I think this gets a little bit of coverage, but I really think it needs more coverage, that communities of color and communities in impoverished areas are way more at risk. You get more crowding in houses. Those communities are more likely to have essential jobs, such as like grocery work or working in the grocery store. Those populations are certainly at risk, and I don't think that enough attention is brought to that. You're seeing increased rates of death, increased rates of severe cases in the Black community and Hispanic community compared to the white community. So yeah, that's definitely a huge thing that I don't think gets talked about enough. And I hope, and I recently posted today about vaccine updates and the way that they've enrolled for these vaccine, the breakdown of the racial and diversity of the participants of the trials. They tried to make it the same as like the population of America, but it's not the same as the effects that we're seeing in this disease. So I thought that was kind of interesting and kind of not made me upset, but I wish that they had taken that more into account when like enrolling for these clinical trials. Like, yes, 60% of our population is white, but that's not how the breakdown of like severity of case and fatality of cases is happening. So yeah, I think that definitely needs more attention.
That's a really good point. And it's part of the reason I'm proud to be a student at the UAlbany School of Public Health, because they have been doing the racial disparity studies, and they do have a lot of like anti-racism resources. So
yeah,
that's the kind of progress that we need to make a better future. Yeah. So is there any other coronavirus related topics that you've been looking at and covering that haven't gotten enough coverage in the mainstream media?
As far as the coronavirus, there are a lot of still unknowns. I know it may come to a shock to people since we've had this. I think a couple of days ago was the 1 year anniversary of the first coronavirus case. So it has officially been around for a year, but there's still a lot that scientists and researchers don't know about it. For example, like long-lasting effects after the disease, I get that question a lot. Or like length of immunity if you've had the disease, I get that question a lot. And we just don't know yet. And part of the reason is it hasn't been around for that long. I know a year, and this year has felt like multiple years to people. But it's really not that long of a time to study something like this. And if you're thinking long-term effects, you need at least 6 months to a year post disease and like recovery to even study that. So I would really like to cover those topics. It's just that we don't know the information yet. So, and I'm sure once we do know that information, the news will probably cover it, I'm hoping. Another thing I want to say, I think that this doesn't get enough news coverage it gets news coverage, but in the wrong way, is that we're pushing these vaccines through at warp speed or whatever. But this isn't new to like fast track something when you have like a new drug come out that is for a specific disease that's really deadly. They also do accelerated drug trials. So I don't want people to panic when they see that these vaccines are coming out as fast as they are, especially with the statistics they have. They look really good. The side effects are not bad at all. I think fatigue is like the worst one. I think the news says that it's going through very fast, but it is very safe. I do want to emphasize that.
Another thing I think you mentioned somewhere is that these early trials have come out with really high effectiveness for the vaccines. Do you think that effectiveness will stay so high after they've been administered?
Yeah, so it's interesting because the way that clinical trials report their data is what's called an efficacy rate, which is basically efficacy of a vaccine in a bubble. These patients are getting their vaccines on time. These two vaccines need two injections multiple weeks apart. So these trial participants are being called in at the right time to get their second vaccination. They're being monitored. The vaccines are also kept in the laboratory conditions that they're meant to be stored and handled in. So those efficacy rates are sort of like in a bubble of the clinical trial. It will be really interesting to see how distribution is handled as far as the vaccines and the multiple doses and how they're going to keep track of who got what injection when and when you need to follow up for your second injection. So yes, I do expect these efficacy rates to drop. By how much, I'm not sure once they're out of that clinical trial bubble, but mostly just because of the two injections that are needed and the special storage conditions that are needed. So Pfizer's vaccine needs to be stored at negative 80 degrees Celsius, which are like research grade freezers. And then the Moderna one is typical freezer, like your kitchen freezer. storage, so that'll be a little bit easier. But yes, I think the effectiveness rates will go down, but it's great that they're starting out so high.
That was HMM volunteer correspondent Spencer Keeble in conversation with Julia Rosenberger, a PhD candidate in chemistry and biochemistry at the University of Delaware, and the founder of The Cheminist, a blog dedicated to publishing important scientific information in posts that are meant to be read by those unfamiliar with science. They discussed the novel coronavirus, feminism in STEM fields, and gave some perspective for those considering pursuing a graduate degree. That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Ben Saratan. Our engineer is Alexis Goldsmith. Remember to tune in every weekday to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or to comment on our work, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in helping with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or join our weekly Zoom meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. by sending an email requesting an invitation link to hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.